Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Lisa Polanski, counsel. My registration number 31539, and I represent the appellate here, Richard Regalado. I would like to reserve three minutes or so for rebuttal, please. The defense of the trial below in this case was that Robert Guess and Thomas Garrison were in fact the shooters of Mr. Sean Rodriguez, and that Mr. Richard Regalado was not in fact there. However, due to trial court error, Mr. Regalado was denied his right to completely present his defense. And as a result, Mr. Regalado's constitutional rights were violated, and this constituted error that was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Robert Guess was the prosecution's primary witness and was in fact, as I've already indicated, the alternate suspect, as it were, the other shooter, along with Mr. Garrison, who had already been convicted. Robert Guess had received a lucrative plea bargain in exchange for his testimony, 12 years in prison. Mr. Guess had admitted his direct connection to the shooting of Mr. Rodriguez in a variety of ways. He admitted shooting someone and lied to the Jackson family in Nevada when he called their home in 2000, at the time he was incarcerated for this very same offense. He said he was going down for a murder for shooting someone. The Jackson family, both the wife and the husband, Veronica Jackson and her husband, were both called by the defense and testified as to that phone call. Mr. Guess had also been seen with one of the alleged murder weapons used in the murder, a black semi-automatic firearm, at Tommy Garrison's house by a defense witness, Lorenzo Victoria Diaz. She had also heard from Kimberly Gomez, Mr. Guess's girlfriend at one time, that Guess had shot Bobo. Bobo was a nickname for Sean Rodriguez, the individual who was shot in this case, in a robbery, felony murder. Mr. Guess also initially denied ever handling any of these weapons, but then later admitted to cleaning the 38 caliber revolver, the silver chrome revolver, that was in fact used in the shooting.
So this, go ahead. So this is all in evidence.
It is, Justice. Yes.
Okay, so where's the difficulty?
I would agree. This is what I'm kind of laying out in response to the government's argument that there's really no other evidence connecting Mr. Guess to the crime. And so therefore, as laid out in People versus Munoz, you would have to show a direct connection to the crime. And therefore, if you can't do that, then you would have to go with the signature test, or the other test that's been laid out in terms of showing that it's so similar that it would have to be Mr. Guess. In other words, you know, like a mark, as we've all seen in the case law, that would show it's so specific to Mr. Guess that only Mr. Guess could have been the other suspect. And what I'm trying to say,
well, let me stop you for a minute.
Yes, Justice.
What evidence are you saying was excluded? You're saying the evidence of his admission that he's going down for shooting someone, that was admitted.
That was admitted, yes, Your Honor.
And that he was seen in possession of a black semi-automatic, that was admitted.
Correct.
So what is your concern about which evidence was not admitted?
Thank you, Justice, for directing me, and I'm going to get right to that. After laying out the connection of Mr. Guess to the shooting in this case, not just as a driver, but in fact as a shooter, there was an attempt by the defense, and obviously quite a bit of litigation, about additional evidence, prior acts by Mr. Guess, specifically one incident in Arizona when Mr. Guess had held a gun to Mr. Israel Esparza's head and robbed him. He then minimized his role in that robbery, despite the fact that Mr. Esparza had described him by physical description to the police, and his co-defendant had implicated him. The defense had Mr. Esparza on call from another state, from Arizona, and that was excluded by the trial court, And the trial court concluded in its written order, as the court is, the court here, I'm sure, is very aware, that 404B would have to be applied, and the defense would have to meet essentially one of the exceptions, which it in fact did, as to identity of the shooter. That was the heart of the defense, was the identity of the shooter.
How does it do that?
How does it do that? Well, in essence, these two incidents, and there were quite a few that the defense laid out in its motion, saying, you know, look, Mr. Guess has a long history of violence and drugs. We're not asking to just muddy the water, so to speak, and get into all that. We're pinpointing two incidents that are similar in nature and show that he is more likely than not, which is the test for relevance, to have been the shooter in this case. Specifically, the incident with Mr. Esparza, just as Mr. Rodriguez had a gun held to his head and then was robbed, he did the same thing, Mr. Guest did the same thing to Mr. Esparza in Arizona. There was also a second incident where there was had been a burglary of a home.
Well, let's just stop on that one for a minute. So how does the fact that, well, let me back up a minute. We have here, this is not a conviction in Arizona, right?
Right.
And the charges were dropped.
Right.
And so we have Mr. Esparza is going to come in, and he's going to testify that Guess held the gun to his head.
Correct.
How does that tend to show that in this particular case, he was the shooter?
And I think this is a good question, Your Honor, because what happens is there's this tension, as we've all seen in the case law, between the right to present alternate defense or alternate suspect defense and 404 and so on. And my reading of the Holmes case, as well as the Muniz case, is that it is, while it's not unfettered, it's not a right that's absolute. It is a constitutional right to present a complete defense. And in this case, Mr. Regalado was prevented from doing that because it's laid out very clearly in Muniz, if a reasonable trier of fact could have found that those facts, hearing from Mr. Esparza, having Mr. Guest point a gun at his head and having been robbed, if the jury, the reasonable trier of fact, could have found that those facts pertaining to that evidence would create a reasonable doubt. That's the test. And so what, in essence, the trial court did was said, you know what, relevance, that's a very low standard.
So are you saying that character evidence under Muniz, character evidence is fair game because the jury might find it persuasive?
No, that's not what I'm saying. I want to really, really distinguish, while on one hand, 404B comes into play, and that's what I was kind of speaking to, that tension. It's not the end all. You first start with, and Muniz, I think, really clarified that, is that when an individual essentially is on trial for murder and has a constitutional right to a fair trial, to present a defense, and the defense is an alternative suspect, albeit this is a little bit odd because it's the co-defendant and the primary prosecution witness. You have all these different things at play. Muniz simply said, look, if you can establish a direct connection, what it comes down to is 401 and 402, all relevant, and 403. All relevant admissible evidence is allowed, as if it goes to the defense, which it does, and I would contend on behalf of the appellate, that an individual pointing a gun at another individual's head, similar to what happened in this case, is relevant. And it should go to the jury to determine how much weight does that really deserve in terms of the defense. We can also look at it.
And it's relevant on what basis?
Again, because it's showing the fact that Mr. Guess has in fact done this before. And in fact, it's very similar in nature, pointing a gun to an individual's head and then robbing them. That's exactly what happened in Sean Rodriguez's case.
So is it that he had a propensity to point guns at people's heads?
And what's I understand where Your Honor's going, and this is where the tension finds itself. And what I would submit to the court is, either way, if you analyze it under the straight up alternate suspect defense, or 404, the defense gets that in. And the reason why, and I know, you know, the government couldn't really wrap their minds around it, it has to be, in an, under an exception, just as the government often does in these cases. If it goes under motive, opportunity, intent, identity, it comes in. It comes in, and that's, on the defense point of view, we rarely use that, but it does come in as an exception as to identity. So it's not, no, I'm just gonna throw mud at the guy to show he's a bad guy. It goes to the identity of the shooter. It also goes to his motive and his opportunity and his intent. So it's an exception to 404B. It's not excluded by 403, because the probative value is more than minimal, but certainly not substantially outweighed by any prejudice, because as this esteemed court knows, the 404 standard is slightly different when it's for defense purposes.
Ms. Polansky, if the standard is not 404B, but just simple relevance, and the trial court has quite a bit of discretion in determining what evidence is relevant and not, and you say it's not unfettered, where would you draw the line as to when it becomes an abuse of discretion?
I think if the court had allowed in, you know, every single time Mr. Guest was arrested and every single time he did anything related to any criminal activity, that would have been above and beyond. And I would slightly change what the court just stated, and that is that it doesn't implicate 404B. I do think it implicates 404B. I don't think it violates 404A. I think that it implicates 404B in that you can say it's not just to show he has a propensity, therefore he's done it again. It's to show under 404B one of the excluded exclusions that does apply and is allowed, which would be identity, motive, opportunity, and so forth. And so under the Muniz case, my understanding is that it would allow for the introduction of such evidence as long as it shows that it goes to identity, which in this case I believe it does. As same as the other act, which was the act where there was another gun pointed at another individual, and that would be Jacqueline Thune Rasmussen, where there had been a burglary of a home where Mr. Guest had stolen drugs and money, and then again pointed a gun at Jacqueline Thune Rasmussen and threatened to kill her. These two incidents, when it comes down to the ability to present a defense, what occurred in this case was constitutional error, because the jury essentially was never told of these incidents, and the judge essentially said, okay, I'm not even going to find that relevant enough for the jury to hear, therefore the jury doesn't get to determine what weight it deserves, and therefore I'm going to stop your defense there.
Ms. Polansky, you mentioned that it's a constitutional error, but doesn't that standard apply only if there has been a complete deprivation of the defense?
I would disagree with Your Honor in that I believe that it's a meaningful opportunity to present a complete defense. And I do think that the trial court in this case made an effort to allow a lot of evidence to come in. But at the same time, when it came down to the crucial determinative factor, the trial court also, and I think this compounded the error, the trial court also excluded evidence of a phone call that Mr. Guest had made while in prison about dealing heroin from the prison. And this again goes directly to the heart of the defense, which was that he wanted to take over the drug business, not Mr. Regalado. Mr. Guest wanted to take over the drug business, and that was corroborated by this phone call he made after he was sent to prison to go ahead and continue on to achieve his aspirations of becoming a heavy hitter drug dealer from prison through East Los Angeles and his brother. And when the court allowed, even though the prosecution had waived their objection to that phone call, when the court allowed that phone call to come in, it compounded that error. And so it did cut off the defense from presenting a complete defense.
Wait a minute. So the court compounded the error in excluding evidence by admitting evidence that the defense wanted?
Well, no. The court excluded the phone call. It first admitted it because the prosecution, according to him, fell asleep at the switch, right. Excuse me. And then the next day came back and said, oops, I forgot and I fell asleep. And so then the judge excluded it. The defense had to take back the transcripts from the jury, and the jury was told, disregard that phone call. So it was excluded. So that being said, and I see my time is running short, I do want to address the cell phone tracking evidence, because I think what we get into here is a cumulative error analysis, because the cell phone tracking evidence was crucial, and the court inappropriately applied the law in that instance and found that the evidence was admissible, even though there was no finding of reliability of that particular testimony. And I see my time is up, so I'm going to pass it to my esteemed opposing counsel. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Polansky.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Kathy Gillespie, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado this morning. My registration number is 26109. I want to jump right into the alternate suspect issue and then address very quickly the expert witness issue. I think that both of us, both defense counsel and I, agree that this is an interplay of a variety of different laws. And I think Salazar, while it was a sex assault case, did discuss how these theories or how these laws of evidence interplay with each other. And I think that, first of all, we need to keep in mind that defense counsel cites a lot of information that came out at trial in the defendant's case in chief. The trial court made this decision at a pretrial motions hearing, and again, right before trial started, and none of the evidence that they presented in their case at trial was introduced to the trial court when it made its decision on the motion prior, before trial even started. So, first of all, I agree with the court that it's not harmless beyond, I mean, it's not a constitutional harmless error issue unless there's a complete denial of the defense. And here I think counsel has pointed out quite clearly that there was a variety of information that was put before the jury about Mr. Guess's less than stellar background and his involvement in this crime and his history of criminal history. Here they say that the identity of the shooter was the heart of the defense, and that under 404, these prior bad acts of Guess would come in so long as they go to show identity, no questions asked. And I think that's an incorrect statement of the law. While the standard for the defendant bringing in prior similars of a witness is different than the prosecution, they still have to be relevant and they still have to pass the 403 balancing test. And here what the trial court found was that if it was coming in for the identity of the shooter, there had to be some similarity between these prior acts and the crime in question. We don't get a lot of factual information from the first one where Guess allegedly was one of two people that pointed a gun at Esponza, I think it was his name. But we do know that that case was dismissed for insufficient evidence and there was no resulting conviction from that.
Ms. Gillespie, I'm sorry. If the standard for admitting prior bad acts is different when the defendant offers it as opposed to the prosecution, then why is it just a minimal relevance and let the jury sort it out rule applicable?
Well, I think relevance is applicable, but my argument is this wasn't relevant. It has to be probative, and here it was just speculative, and the probative value of this evidence was pretty minimal. Like I said with the first one, there were allegedly two people, one of which was Mr. Guess, who pointed a gun at this individual's head 6 years before the crime that took place here. The trigger was never pulled, and there was no resulting conviction, and in fact, the case was dismissed for insufficient evidence. The second is,
Well, under 404B, there doesn't have to be a conviction for the evidence to be admissible, right?
No, there doesn't. I just think it's one thing to consider as far as the relevancy. And also under 403, the undue delay. I mean, if these priors had come in, the prosecution then would have had the opportunity to rebut this evidence. And so we would have had these little mini trials about what happened in 2000, what happened in 2006. And I think the trial court, within its discretion, found that the similarities just weren't similar enough for this to be relevant on the issue of identity. The second one, which was involved a woman in 2006, was a roommate of Mr. Guess's. He allegedly, not during the robbery or burglary, but later showed her a safe with some loot from the burglary in it, and then allegedly pointed a gun at her and told her that he'd kill her if she turned him in. That case was never reported to the police. There were no documentation on that. And again, it really wasn't relevant on the issue of identity in this case because there just weren't any similarities to it. Their identity is not that Mr. Guess was involved in this crime. He admits he was involved in the crime. He admits he was the driver. The identity is whether or not he was the actual shooter in this case. And at the time of the pretrial motions hearing, the evidence that the trial court had and the evidence that was presented by both counsel was that there was nothing putting Mr. Guess inside the apartment. He testified that he waited outside down the steps. There were multiple witnesses who testified at trial that the prosecutor argued in the motions hearing that don't even like Mr. Guess and had allegiances to the defendant in this case, confirmed multiple points through Mr. Guess's story as to what took place before, during, and after the crime. There was no blood found on Mr. Guess. The injury that was given to Mr. Garrison, because he was standing behind the victim when Mr. Rigaldo fired into his head and killed him, all of that, there was nothing to really show or to support the defendant's theory that Guess was the shooter. Now, I understand that that was their theory, but just because it's their theory doesn't mean that any piece of evidence that they want admitted that they think supports that theory comes in. And I think in this case, under an abuse of discretion standard, the trial court weighed those two priors, the theory of relevance from the defense as to what it was being used for. And when it came down to it, the heart of it being the identity of the shooter, there was nothing similar about those two prior crimes sufficient enough in the trial court's mind to justify admitting it. And he talked about the undue delay, confusion of the issues. And I think it's what it exactly comes down to is this was propensity evidence. They wanted to show that Guess was this miserable human being who had pulled guns on people before, and therefore it was more likely than not that he was the one that went into the apartment here, put the gun at Mr. Rodriguez's head and pulled the trigger. The problem with that is there's just no evidence to support it. Neither of those priors made any indication that Guess was anything other than a thug. He had never pulled the trigger when he had pulled a weapon in the past. All of the witnesses confirmed that there were motives for the defendant in this case to shoot Mr. Rodriguez. There was never any testimony at trial or presented at the pretrial hearing even as to why Guess would have been the one to walk into this apartment and shoot Mr. Rodriguez out of the blue. So I think that Salazar lays out very clearly how these different rules of evidence intersect, and I think when the trial court in this case applied those different rules, the record supports its decision, and if that's the case, then the ruling stands. I think that once they got to trial, the defense was allowed to bring in a variety of pieces of information, which quite frankly were much more persuasive than these two priors. The statement in jail that he was going down for a shooting someone is not a confession. The fact that he's going down for a crime of shooting somebody doesn't mean he shot them. And also that somebody had seen him with the same type of gun. They had talked about his priors. Mr. Guess admitted on the stand that he had no problem lying to police when minimizing his involvement would get him a plea deal. The plea deal came into evidence. So there was a variety of information that the jury was allowed to hear as to the credibility and to Mr. Guess's character, for lack of a better word. But these two priors, there just wasn't enough probative value in these two for the issues that they wanted to admit them for. I think the fact that one of them at least was so remote in time as well, I think this would have been a sideline circus that would have overtaken what the jury was really there to decide. And I think all of that was within the trial court's discretion, and it did a good job of laying out why it was making its ruling and all the different theories that the defense down in the trial court had asked for this evidence to be admitted at trial.
Ms. Gillespie,
yes, sir.
In your view, is this a 404B issue or not? Or is it simply a 401, 403 issue?
I think it's a 404 issue. I mean, it's prior instances of conduct that are being asked to come in. I think that the cases, Salazar and Perez and some of those, make clear that the standard is lower. They don't have to go through the rigor of the 404B process or the test under SPOTO if the defense is bringing them in. But I do think that when they say that it's a 404 issue, the case law then says that the consideration is relevancy and 403, the prejudicial impact of the evidence or the undue delay, confusion of the issues, things like that. So I think ultimately it ends up coming under just the general rules of evidence and how those all interplay.
So how does this case differ on some principled basis from Munoz?
I think it's mostly the similarities of the prior acts. I think that when you look at the other cases where defendants have been allowed to bring in prior similar acts to show an alternate suspect, the link between those acts and the crime in question are enormous, and there's laundry lists of all of those. And I think that here, whether it was a lack of presentation at the pretrial hearing, there just wasn't that link, using it to show identity of the alternate suspect. And I think that the case law makes clear that they can't use evidence of an alternate suspect that's asking for speculation from the jury, that we're just going to throw a bunch of stuff in there and hope that the jury picks one of these theories as to why the defendant's innocent. The evidence didn't support it. The evidence that they presented at the motions hearing wasn't sufficient to meet even the basic requirements of 401 and 403.
All right, let's go back to the, I think it's the Arizona incident. In this case, we have a robbery where the victim is shot in the head with a gun. In the Nevada case, we have a robbery where the victim has a gun pointed at his head. So the distinction here is that, as you said, the trigger wasn't pulled. Why is that such a significant difference that it becomes irrelevant?
Because that's what they want to use it for. They want to use that prior to identify Robert Guess as the shooter in this case. Not that he was involved in the crime or involved in the robbery, but that he was the actual shooter. And what they want to do is use the fact that he's pulled a gun on someone else before as substantive evidence of a theory that because he did it in the past, he was likely the one that went into the apartment in this case and shot Mr. Rodriguez in the head. The other thing to remember is that, yes, they did, when they went into the apartment, the defendant and Garrison went into the apartment to kill Mr. Rodriguez. They did search the apartment for drugs, but from the evidence that was presented at trial, this was a drug business between the defendant, Garrison, and the victim, Rodriguez. And because of money that was owed and wanting to take over the business, it was Regaldo that set this up in order to go in to mastermind this change of authority within the drug business. So it's not what you typically think of as a robbery where somebody goes in just for the purpose of taking money or taking drugs out of the apartment. There was testimony at trial that this was kind of a much bigger plan by the defendant, that he owed Mr. Rodriguez money. He wanted to take over the business. He wasn't happy with the way Mr. Rodriguez was treating his niece. He had gotten her pregnant. There was some testimony of some abuse, domestic abuse between the defendant's niece, who was dating the victim, Mr. Rodriguez. So this isn't a stranger robbery, and I think that some of those differences too come into play as well as to why the fact that they want to use this to identify Mr. Guess as the shooter, you just need more similarities than that if it's coming in for the purposes of identity. And you, there's certainly enough evidence in the record to support the trial court's use of discretion at the level and with the information that the trial court had in front of it when it was when it made the decision as to whether or not these priors were admissible. Just quickly, the phone call in prison about the drug deals, the theory on, in her opening argument about that that was being admitted to take over, to show that guests wanted to take over the drug business, that was never mentioned in the trial court. That's a new theory here on appeal. Down at the trial court, they wanted that to come in to impeach Mr. Guess. So the people call Mr. Guess as a witness. They go through their entire direct examination. On cross-examination, the defense attorney stands up and asks Mr. Guess, the reason why you came forward and wanted to help the prosecution in this case is because you wanted to change your life. You wanted to take advantage of the opportunities in DOC, get an education, get a skill, and get out and change your life. In order to impeach that statement that they elicited, they wanted to introduce this phone call about an alleged heroin distribution within the, I'm not sure if it was the county jail or the prison system. And so I think we need to be clear about what that theory was that came in trial and not confuse it with theories that now are being raised for the first time on appeal. And one quick point under 608B is that wanting to impeach Mr. Guess for that statement about wanting a better life was not a substantive issue of a fact in this case. It was a reason for Mr. Guess wanting to testify or be part of a plea bargain, and I think that's an important distinction for the court. So if the court doesn't have any more questions, I'm out of time.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll accept this case.
Number one.
Over 30 seconds.
Oh, is that right?
Did I?
You went over 30 seconds.
Oh. See, I'm not very good at telling time. May I just respond to the record, misunderstanding?
Okay, you've got two sentences.
I can do that. It was actually raised in the court below with regard to not only it going to impeach Mr. Guess, but also going directly to the alternate suspect theory. I re-reviewed the transcript myself because I was questioning that in my mind and this morning. It is, in fact, raised at the trial court level. And I think that's my two sentences, so thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. The case stands submitted. We will issue an opinion in due course. And we-